Still hurting from Hurricane Maria, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Puerto Rico's coffee crop was devastated by Hurricane Maria and still hasn't recovered, which means farmers are still feeling the pain.
I've been here for 55 years, but now I can't continue because Maria. I lost everything.
Also, President Trump has questioned the effectiveness of the NATO military alliance. The late Senator John McCain was critical of Trump for that. Now there's a call to name the alliance's new headquarters after McCain, and this former U.S. ambassador to NATO likes the idea.
It sends the strong message that while we may have ups and downs in our policy with particular administrations or particular presidents, the fundamentals of the strength of that alliance remain.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is good to have you with us this Friday. The week ends as it began with tributes to the late Republican Senator John McCain. The memorials and remembrances began in Arizona and conclude in Annapolis, Maryland, where McCain will be buried Sunday. But today, his body lay in state at the Capitol in Washington, where his fellow lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, honored him. McCain had made it clear that President Trump was not welcome at any of his funeral events. So today it was Vice President Mike Pence who spoke for the administration.
We gather here today to honor an American patriot, served a cause greater than himself. And we gather here remembering a man who knew how he wanted to be remembered.
In fact, McCain planned all of the events being held this week to remember him. But here's one tribute the late senator didn't plan on, a call from the three former secretaries general of NATO to have the military alliance's new headquarters in Belgium named after McCain. Ewald Dalder was U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Obama. He's now president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Ambassador, do you support this call to name NATO HQ after Senator McCain?
Well, I think it's a very good idea. John McCain was many things, but one of the things he was someone who embodied and championed the Transatlantic Alliance for all of his political life. He was a strong supporter of NATO. He was a frequent visitor to NATO countries. He was the person who led for many, many years, decades, really the U.S. delegation to the Munich Security Conference, the most important security conference in the transatlantic relationship. So it is a fitting tribute to a man who has done an extraordinary amount to keep the transatlantic alliance healthy and strong.
President Trump, as we all know, has questioned NATO usefulness. And just last month, he rallied other members of the alliance at the annual NATO summit by berating them again for not spending enough on defense. And Senator McCain issued a response saying Americans and their Congress still believe in the transatlantic alliance. I mean, that's a kind of extraordinary rebuke by McCain. If this headquarters is named after him, I mean, doesn't that kind of reflect the deep discord in this country right now over what NATO is all about?
Well, I'm not sure there is a deep discord in the country about NATO. At the time that the president was at the NATO summit, the U.S. Senate voted 97-2 to reaffirm America's fundamental commitment to NATO. And the U.S. House of Congress voted unanimously to reaffirm that support for NATO. We at the Chicago Council have done opinion polling and find that American support for NATO was higher than almost at any other time since our polling started in the mid-1970s. So I think the president, when it comes to NATO, may be an outlier. The Americans, and John McCain embodies this, have been strong and continue to be strong supporters of the transatlantic alliance.
So if this plan happens, if HQ is named after McCain, what kind of message would it send to the world about U.S. foreign policy right now?
Well, I think it sends the strong message that there are enduring values. There is an enduring structure of American foreign policy that has looked to Europe as an alliance, as part of a relationship that has endured now since the end of World War II. And while we may have ups and downs in our policy with particular administrations and particular presidents, the fundamentals of the strength of that reliance remain.
Do you think it'll happen? What are you hearing?
I think there's a lot of support for this. I think there is a lot of interest in Europe to recognize the strong bond across the alliance, to understand that whatever differences there may be with Mr. Trump and his policies at the moment, the fundamentals of the alliance and of the relationship remain strong. And reminding people of that by naming the building after Senator McCain is a fitting tribute.
Ivo Dalder, President of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, thanks very much for your time, Ambassador.
My pleasure.
The NATO alliance is more than a military force. It's also a symbol of a unified Europe. But just take a listen to this. Those are protesters chanting in Chemnitz, a city in eastern Germany. They've been taking to the streets all week there. "We are the folk," is what they're chanting, the folk being the people. It's a slogan that Germans used when the Berlin Wall came down. But these days, "We are the folk" has a different connotation. It's a nationalist rallying cry in today's Germany, often associated with the far right and extremist groups. There's a backstory to the protests in Chemnitz. On Sunday, a 35-year-old man was fatally stabbed there. Two men, an Iraqi and a Syrian, were detained as suspects. Apparently, that's all supporters of the far right needed to know. They seized the moment and took to the streets. Some of them were seen flashing Nazi salutes. Protesters also chanted, "Foreigners out," and groups of them even chased down people they thought were immigrants in targeted attacks. Sarah Huckel is a reporter in Germany with ABC News, and she joins us from Berlin. So this stabbing happened in Chemnitz. What can you tell us about the suspects and the victim?
So the victim was a 35-year-old known only as Daniel H. That's per German legal requirements and releasing names. There was thought to be an altercation, and now two young men, a Syrian citizen and an Iraqi citizen, have been taken into custody. That's kind of the starting point, and how it prompted violence is kind of the next part of the story, let's say.
Yes, so take us to that part of the tale. How did it get to the point where people are now rioting in the streets of Chemnitz?
So there were some different factors. There was a lot of false information circulating on the internet, specifically that Daniel H., the man who unfortunately died in this event, died defending a woman from these attackers of non-German citizenry, let's say. There was also another rumor that was swirling around that a second person was killed. And specifically, people in far-right extremist circles circulated this information and used it as a kind of rallying cry to get people on the street. So very spontaneous rioting broke out in a kind of mob-like atmosphere. There was some very strong anti-foreigner sentiment, people shouting things, going after people who looked foreign, let's say. That was the first part of what actually happened. A couple of days later, you've had many German officials saying that actually this violence, which started as a result of what we could essentially call fake news, fake information that was just coming out via Twitter and other social media platforms.
Right. So once the authorities denied these fake news stories that the man was defending a woman, et cetera, did the anger die back a little bit?
I would say no. I think frustration still that many people have with Chancellor Merkel's decision to allow about 1 million refugees into the country in 2015. Migration is a major political topic at the moment. So I think what happened with this action, it was something that really motivated a lot of people to act in a fully unacceptable way.
Well, Chancellor Merkel responded to the protests in Chemnitz, saying, quote, "I can only stress that this has nothing to do with the rule of law in this country. There can be no place in our streets for such rioting." What you point out, the criticism of Merkel opening the door so wide to refugees in Germany, she's faced that criticism before. How's she responding this time?
Yeah, well, I think she's maintained a pretty hard line in this regard in terms of, you know, they've identified at least 10 people who were doing the Heil Hitler salute, which is illegal in Germany, during the rioting on Sunday and Monday. So it's very important that Chancellor Merkel sticks her ground and speaks out very loudly against this kind of anti-foreigner sentiment, obviously, given the country's history. However, she's also suffered quite a lot in the region of Saxony, which is where Chemnitz is located. This is a region where the far right anti-Islam party, the Alternative for Germany, did very well. 25% of the voters actually voted for this party. So kind of a whirlwind of many different issues in this region that so many people did mobilize to act in this way.
So how risky would you say it is, Sarah, to be a refugee right now in Chemnitz?
I would imagine if you are a refugee in Chemnitz right now, you're probably not feeling very comfortable. I think part of the issue is that the people who were out on the streets on Monday and in some cases since then, or who are expressing their discontent, are not necessarily far-right extremists. There are a lot of citizens who are expressing their discontent in general, upset about, I've read some people saying, you know, why let a knife-wielding foreigner into our country? I mean, certainly if you're reading about your neighbors, people in your community saying things like that, as a refugee, you're not going to feel very welcomed or comfortable.
Yeah, and I guess for many others in Germany, that fact that it's not just extremists out there in the street has to be especially concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is exactly what the government is going to have to deal with and what German society is really going to have to take a long, hard look at.
Sarah Huckel, a reporter in Berlin with ABC News. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got an update now on a story we've covered on the show before. Bobi Wine, the famous singer and politician in Uganda, was rearrested yesterday. Wine was said to be in dire condition. His supporters protested again today in Kampala. They say Wine has been tortured while in jail. The Ugandan government charged Wine with treason last week. Earlier, I spoke with Robert Amsterdam, who is representing Wine in this case. I asked him to explain why his client was arrested.
I can't. There's no logical explanation. No explanation why someone who's been brutally tortured would be tortured again, as he was when he was thrown into a police ambulance and then beaten with the light bulb switched off and a doctor witnessing the beating. I have no idea what the Ugandan authorities have in mind when they engage in this kind of brutal conduct, not only with respect to Bobby, but with respect to 30 of his colleagues who are doing nothing more than exercising their Ugandan constitutional rights and their international treaty rights to participate in elections. So we are very concerned about Bobby's health. He's locked in a hospital room right now. He's just completed what is going for an independent examination. He wouldn't allow them to take blood or do anything because he has no faith in the Ugandan doctors right now.
So he was trying to leave the country to seek medical care, I gather, in the U.S. When the report suggests his condition is dire, what does that mean?
It means that he was badly beaten with a metal rod, and there are parts of his body that are in tremendous pain. And we believe he may have sustained permanent damage, but we're really at a loss to express fully what went on because he hasn't been seen by any doctor he trusts at this point.
And when you say he's not going to take blood, or it sounds like he doesn't want needles in his body, what does he think might...
Well, he was injected. We don't know with what. Allegedly, the Ugandans have a habit of injecting political prisoners with toxins. He has had burn marks show up on his hands. We don't know exactly what they've done, and he wasn't going to allow any more injections into his body.
Even as he appeared in court on crutches, the Ugandan government is still claiming that Bobi Wine is in fine condition. Why?
Because they have to. You know, I've been doing these kinds of cases for almost 40 years, and I've never seen a government, when you accuse them of torture, say, yeah, you got us. In this particular case, you had 30 healthy people arrested and come into court a few days later, unable to walk, some of them still bleeding, badly beaten. It's shocking. It shocks the conscience of the world. And we are doing everything we can to make the world aware of what's been going on in Museveni's Uganda.
So, Robert, you wrote in The Guardian that you're calling for the Magnitsky Act to be put into action. I thought the Magnitsky Act was supposed to punish Russian officials responsible for the death of this tax accountant, Magnitsky. How can that be put into action in the case of a singer from Uganda, a politician who's in detention?
Because it's been extended. It's been made a global act. In fact, a number of Venezuelans have been added to it. And I can tell you that the Magnitsky Act is one of the few things that exists in the world which allow individuals who have engaged in these kinds of illegal activities to be brought to justice through having their assets seized and their travel limited.
Robert, what's your take? How can Bobi Wine be helped?
Listen, to American listeners, they need to know that their war on terror has empowered Museveni with hundreds of millions of dollars of armaments, which he is using to torture his own people. And I think it's a massive lesson for American taxpayers. We need to really reassess what the war on terror is doing when all of those monies and armaments are being given to despots to torture their own people.
And that is the case with U.S. foreign aid for Uganda?
It is indeed.
Lawyer Robert Amsterdam represents the embattled Ugandan singer and politician Bobi Wine. Speaking with us from London, Robert, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Our theme for the next few minutes here on the show is coffee. And we start with some very big news for the caffeinated beverage industry. Coca-Cola has agreed to buy UK-based coffee shop chain Costa for $5.1 billion. Here's some quick analysis from Manuela Zaragoza with the BBC's business unit.
Today, Costa is the UK's biggest coffee chain. It has more than 2,400 coffee shops here in the UK. Plus, in addition, it has 1,400 outlets abroad. What does Coca-Cola get out of it? Well, it's a leap into the global coffee market, something that was missing from Coca-Cola's portfolio. Had very little presence in that market. That's obviously going to change now. It also gives them a brand with which to take on the likes of Starbucks, which has 29,000 outlets globally. And compare that to Costa's 4,000. There's a lot of catching up to do. But I think it's fair to assume that in future, wherever you see the Coca-Cola brand, you're also going to be seeing the Costa brand.
I am already wired. Manuela Zaragoza with the BBC's business unit there in London. And while we're on the subject of caffeinated beverages, let me segue cleverly here to our next story about coffee with a note about something we've got on the show for you Monday. Trivia, as in really meaningful trivia from the brains at The Economist magazine. I'll park this brain stumper here for you to think about over the weekend. Brazil has been the world's biggest producer of coffee for over 150 years, but can you name the other four Latin American countries among the world's top 10 coffee producers? Think about that. You've got until Monday. Okay, coffee, sadly, is not a crop Puerto Rico can rely on much right now. Last year, Hurricane Maria destroyed 85% of the crops there and cost the ag sector more than $2 billion. Some things like bananas have bounced back, but the coffee industry is a different story. It takes years for new plants to grow and produce beans, so the island's coffee regions are still badly hurting. The world's Carolyn Beeler went to the western Puerto Rican region of Maricao to talk to a farmer who lost everything and a group of women trying to help people like him.
There's a dimly lit convenience store in the mountains of western Puerto Rico where an 82-year-old man sits behind the counter ringing up snacks and sodas.
Thank you very much.
He wishes he were somewhere else, outside in the sun, tending the coffee plants he farmed for decades.
I've been here for 55 years, but now I can continue because Maria, I lost everything. The coffee, bananas, the orange, I lost everything.
Hurricane Maria destroyed the crops on Luis Ruiz's 22 acres. The storm also seems to have destroyed his spirit.
I don't think I come back.
Why not replant?
Because we don't have money. And I owe the farm to the bank, too. I think I'm going to lose the farm.
Even if he wanted to replant, a coffee harvest wouldn't come in for 3 or 4 years. I asked Ruiz, who has watery blue eyes and a sparse white beard, to show me the damage to his fields. But he said no.
I don't want to see it. Tell my son to go with you.
So I head into the fields with Luis Ruiz Jr. He walks me down the hill behind the store, over the dried-out leaves of dead banana trees.
Why, everything was full of plantain and coffee. And now you can see the coffee trees are dry.
They look like skeletons, just like most of the coffee plants around here. Luis Ruiz Jr. is wearing ripped jeans and black leather motorcycle boots that seem out of place in a farm field. He moved back here from Orlando 5 years ago to care for his aging parents, but he doesn't really know how to help now.
You see, my father, Faye, he's so sad. He's in very bad depression. I don't like to see my father like that.
Even before Maria, this region was hurting. The number of farms had dropped by more than two-thirds in the last quarter century. Then Maria came, driving hundreds of thousands of people off the island. Many abandoned farms like this one. But both government and grassroots efforts aim to stem the flow and strengthen agriculture here. And two women who grew up here in Maricao are part of that grassroots movement.
We have to motivate the farmers to come to the soil again.
That's Chris Rodriguez, a retired Army Sergeant Major who owns a coffee farm nearby. She's working with a handful of local women, including Jackie Perez, a civil engineer who sources beans for her chocolate business and cafe from local farms.
Right now, there's many people emigrate to United States, and we need to stop it.
The women's plan to stop it is to build an agricultural education center to inspire farmers to replant their crops and teach them how to make more money farming.
We have to train these people to get better in the agriculture, to get a better coffee, specialty coffees.
Rodriguez and Perez have an idea of how to make that happen. They drive me to a local school that was just shut down. It's one of more than 260 across the island closed due to low enrollment after Maria.
We are in the front of the gate right now. This is the main entrance of the school. This school is already empty.
Community activists around the island want to give these shuttered schools new life. Perez and Rodriguez hope to put this one to work for farmers by teaching them better planting and harvesting techniques. University of Puerto Rico Agricultural Extension Officer Salvador Baez explains that this project fits into an ongoing effort to improve coffee quality in the region.
Maricao tiene las condiciones climáticas.
Maricao has the right climate to produce really good quality coffee. And because of that, we want our farmers to elevate the quality of the coffee they produce.
They want Maricao coffee to be higher quality and widely recognizable, like Kona coffee from Hawaii.
Para lograr eso, el único proceso es educación.
The only way to do that is with education, and this place can serve as a center for education.
To prove they can operate the school if they get it, Perez and Rodriguez need money. They want to raise $150,000. Wilfredo Ruiz, who represents all of Puerto Rico's coffee processors, supports the women's project, but argues the government needs to step in to revive the region's struggling coffee industry.
In terms of economic activity and reasons to live here, it's the coffee industry.
Congress set aside more than $2 billion to help U.S. farmers cover crop losses from last year's hurricanes and wildfires. But Ruiz argues that's not going to be enough for Maricao.
Si desaparece, los que vivimos en esta región tenemos dos alternativas.
If it disappears, those of us who live in this region have two options. Either we immigrate to the United States or we immigrate to big cities like Bayamón or San Juan.
Perez and Rodriguez want to stop that migration and are attempting something of a Hail Mary to save their hometown.
What we're trying to do is to try to keep the people here in this town.
If they don't have the opportunities, maybe
they leave.
They leave. But if we offer education and the possibility of new employment, they can stay here.
This is important to both women because they grew up working in their parents' coffee fields nearby.
That's my town, that's my community. Everything is possible.
Back at the Ruiz family farm, things are a little less optimistic. Luis Jr. welcomes any jobs that the project might bring, but he's not counting on it to help his dad. Ever the dutiful son, though, he's looking for hope elsewhere.
Powerball and Lotto. I'm playing Lotto every day to see if I win the money to pay the mortgage.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Maricao, Puerto Rico.
I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. and Canada have an agreement on how refugees seek asylum. It's based on the idea that both countries treat refugees fairly. But some Canadians are not so sure about that.
It poses then a question about the legality of Canada's actions in continuing to pretend that the United States is a safe country.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There's been a lot of friction between Canada and the U.S. lately, most recently over trade. We're going to spend the next few minutes, though, exploring how the two countries treat asylum seekers. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been looking into all of this. You've been spending a lot of time at the border lately, Rupa. Where exactly?
I went to this spot, if you imagine where Niagara Falls is.
Right, sitting kind of right on the border of the United States and Canada.
Exactly. And then go a little bit south from there. And there's this little town on the Canadian side. It looks like a Midwestern town called Fort Erie. And then there's a bridge across the Niagara River called the Peace Bridge to the other side, Buffalo, New York, which is a very different place. And I started there at this shelter that's a big, unmarked brick building.
Hi.
And you have to get buzzed in.
How are you?
Really well.
I'm here to see Mariah.
Mariah. Your name is?
Rupa.
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 I was there to see Mariah Walker. She's the nonprofit shelter manager. She helps people apply for asylum in Canada. So this is where you go in the United States to stay for a few days while you start your paperwork and wait for an appointment with an immigration officer.
So this spot was the most popular border crossing into Canada before 2017. Then Trump comes in, and then what happens?
Before Trump, Walker says, people only had to stay here like a couple days before they got an appointment with an immigration officer, a Canadian immigration officer. After Trump, in early 2017, she says it was chaos. The place was at capacity. They had to send people to other shelters and churches. People were waiting weeks for appointments.
So this is the luggage room. It's actually funny. This is like one of everybody's favorite thing to see because it's usually like when we had, you know, hundreds of people here, it was just like overflowing. So this is kind of where everybody keeps their luggage. We keep it locked up.
Everybody's favorite thing to see? Like, should we been giving tours, like journalists?
Yeah, actually, they were featured in The New Yorker. So gotcha. They've had some people visit them. But I understood why this was the place people wanted to see, because there's some kind of really strange, sad thing going on.
Well, visually, I mean, suitcases.
Yeah, weather-beaten, old, tagged suitcases.
We were housing people who would normally only be here for a couple of days, for weeks on end. And so people were getting anxious and they were getting frustrated and it's, you know, blizzarding outside.
She says it was like that, absolute chaos, until about November 2017.
The numbers just stopped and people just stopped coming.
So November 2017, what happened?
I need a little time to answer that question. So put a pin in it for a second.
Okay.
While Walker and I were talking, we were interrupted by a woman who was giving us some ice cream. It was all she could find at the corner store to say thank you.
Token of love.
Thank you so much.
We spent only 4 days, but it's like very good.
Thank you.
And then the next day, I saw her across the bridge in Fort Erie, Ontario, at this welcome center attached to the Canadian border post. And she actually saw me. I didn't see her.
Yeah, I was in Vive.
You wear green over there.
I wear the same thing, except green.
Okay. What was going on there?
Okay.
Fashion? Conversation?
She pointed out that I was wearing the same dress as I had worn before, except in a different color. When I see a dress I like, I double down.
I'm not judging. Go for it.
Okay. So the Welcome Center, basically, it looks like a waiting room at a dentist's office.
This is the Welcome Center in Fort Erie, Ontario.
Exactly. Yeah. But through the window of this dentist's office, you can see like a sea of cars going through the Border Patrol checkpoint.
This is where it all happens. There isn't anything like this in Canada except here. We provide them with information about the refugee claim process, you know, shattering some myths, that kind of stuff.
So that's Martha Mason. I met her there. She's a volunteer. And she had this whole history to tell me of this place. 30 years ago, they started to see all these migrants from El Salvador. And that's when they started trying to help them. So they set up networks of volunteers on both sides of the Peace Bridge to, like, at Vive in Buffalo, give them a place to stay, give them an appointment with an immigration officer, bring them over to this newcomer center, and then after that, send them to another shelter.
So you're saying that the shelter that you are at in Buffalo, on the other side of the bridge, Vive, that's part of this whole welcoming system, ushering refugees into Canada, and that all started on the Canadian side. So this is like a binational effort to help refugees?
Yeah, by residents.
Wow.
That just kind of grew up in a grassroots way.
That's kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't even think they realized it at the time. I'm pretty sure that they didn't. But it was the relationship building that led to the development of this center and the system that we have here, because it's very unique.
They built this system, and it worked great for like 20 years. She says back then they saw about 500 people every month.
It was very busy. Yeah, we were open 7 days a week.
And then the U.S. and Canada changed the rules. They came up with something called the Safe Third Country Agreement.
What's that?
Basically, the two countries saw the flow of refugees going up to Canada and realized that they were getting some doubles. Like, people were applying both in the U.S. and Canada. And they thought, okay, we'll cut down on some paperwork by saying people can only apply in the first country they get to. So if you land in the U.S., you have to apply there. You can't also go and apply in Canada.
So you can't double dip for asylum in both countries.
Exactly. But that only applies at official border crossings. So that's why when Trump was elected, after Trump was elected, people started going to this one place in Quebec where you could walk across the woods unofficially into Canada.
And is there any penalty for that?
I mean, it's a really risky thing to do. People have died that way in the wintertime.
But other than that, I mean, no, that they have the same chance for asylum as everyone else. And that comes into play in some really interesting ways. And for this, I'm going to take you to the next place I went, a shelter in Fort Erie on the Canadian side called Casa Norte. They were going through all these bags of donated clothes. That's where I met this mother named Fabiola Vargas. She and her family are originally from Colombia. They fled the violence there. Then they lived undocumented in the U.S. for about 4 years, and they were really scared of the Trump administration's immigration policies. But when news hit of families being separated at the border, that really took things to a next level for them. Vargas was convinced it was time to leave the U.S. So she's saying, it's so different. We're in a world where the U.S. is like a horror film. We went from one in Colombia, saw it happen in the U.S., and thank God for Canada.
Yeah, but from what you told me, Rupa, regarding the Safe Third Country Agreement, they should have been turned away at the official border crossing because they were supposed to apply for asylum in the States, right?
Right.
So how'd they get to Canada?
One of her adult sons crossed into Canada unofficially by walking through the woods into Quebec. And once in Canada, he could apply for asylum. And presto, Vargas and her husband had a family member in Canada. And they could apply for a loophole in the Safe Third Country Agreement.
Okay.
Because they had family in Canada, they could come over legally.
Totalmente diferente. O sea, no nos van a discriminar.
She said she never meant to come to Canada, but she's very grateful to be here because they don't discriminate the same way that she felt like she was discriminated against in the U.S. It was actually really striking how many moms talked about the child separation policy. It had a big effect on moving them, even if they weren't in danger of being separated from their children. This is Carmen Carvajal, who lived in the U.S. for 2 years after fleeing gangs in El Salvador.
Qué doloroso es ver ahora en las noticias eso de que les estaban quitando los hijos. Yo soy madre de dos niñas y preferiría que me mataran a que me las quitaran.
You can hear it in her voice. She's like, it's so painful to watch the news of them taking the children away. I'm the mother of two girls, and I would prefer they killed me before they're taken away.
Creo que todo el que tiene corazón, todo el que tiene sentimiento.
People who support Trump will one day see that separating families was a bridge too far, and the people who support him will repent.
So that was Carmen. What about the woman from Colombia and her family, Fabiola Vargas? What do you expect will become of her asylum claim?
Actually, all of them have a pretty good chance just because Canada has a really high rate of acceptance, one of the highest in the world. It's like 65 to 70%. And most recently, because of the family separation news, there's a growing movement in Canada to overturn the Safe Third Country Agreement.
Right, the agreement where you can only apply for asylum in the first country you get to.
Exactly. Because the agreement is based on the idea that refugees are safe in both countries.
If that premise ever held true, it is certainly arguable that it does not hold true anymore. That the United States is no longer a safe country for people to seek refugee protection.
Whoa, who is that?
That's Audrey Macklin. She's a professor at the University of Toronto, and she used to sit on the Immigration Board of Canada, which is basically the body that decides who gets refugee status in Canada. She says the Safe Third Country Agreement should be reevaluated because Canada has to ask itself if it can responsibly reject migrants and leave them in the hands of the U.S., when the U.S. might send them back to where they came from, to the country they're fleeing.
And if that happens, then everybody's complicit. Right? So it imposes then a question about the legality of Canada's actions in continuing to pretend that the United States is a safe country, all evidence to the contrary.
That is a real dilemma. I mean, what does it all mean, Rupa? And is there any chance the agreement will change? Like, is Canada evaluating or reevaluating if it should get out of this deal?
Either country can suspend it at any time. But so far, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau hasn't shown any inclination to do that. There was this exchange on the floor of the House of Commons between him and member Jenny Kwan of Vancouver. She actually immigrated to Canada from Hong Kong with her family when she was 9. You're going to hear her talk first.
Many refugees are crossing the border illegally, risking life and limb because they have no other option. Things will only get worse. So will this Prime Minister finally act, and will he suspend the unfair agreement and support border communities and help those desperate refugees?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, Canada is opening
so this is
open
Justin
and
Trudeau.
Welcoming country, and one of the reasons we are able to continue to be open and welcoming is that Canadians have confidence in the integrity of our borders and the integrity of our immigration system. We will continue to ensure that laws are enforced and followed, and that we remain demonstrating the strength and the integrity of our immigration system. We will be welcoming, but we need to make sure that it's done properly at the same time by all officials in Canada.
So people have interpreted that to mean there's not going to be a lot of movement there. And so that's why some groups, including Amnesty International and the Canadian Council for Refugees, are challenging the Safe Third Country Agreement in court. They hope to suspend it or even revoke it. And that case is scheduled to begin in January.
Incredible. So what would happen if the agreement was suspended or revoked?
Some say that a lot more migrants will head to Canada. But while we're talking about this, you have to keep in mind that just like there are people pushing for an overturn of the Safe Third Country Agreement, there are people emerging on the other side. And Canada's done a lot to keep migrants away. It sent representatives to the U.S. and other countries to spread the word that it's not so easy to get refugee status in Canada. And after Canada saw an initial spike in Nigerian refugees, it asked the U.S. to be stricter when granting Nigerian visas, so fewer people could actually go to the U.S. and then go to Canada.
Wow, it's making my head spin because it kind of contradicts a lot of things I think I thought I knew about Canada.
Yeah, it's way more complicated than you might think. So I want to take us back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Remember Vive?
The shelter back in Buffalo.
Right. That's the one that saw a drop in people coming to it in November 2017. And Mariah Walker, the manager, remember her?
Yep.
She says there might be another reason for the drop. Anecdotally, she's seen a lot of stepped-up immigration enforcement across the U.S. and along Canada's border.
We've scheduled appointments for people, and they were literally on their way here, and they were detained. It's not uncommon for them to get on the bus and check everybody's immigration status. But, of course, they're only asking, you know, black and brown people. They're not asking any white people.
We don't have any numbers to know if what she's saying is correct. But anecdotally, I heard a lot of people say the same thing.
And when she's talking about they get on the bus, she's talking about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yeah, and U.S. Border Patrol. It has authority within 100 miles of the border.
We thought we were in it for the long haul. Like, we thought people were just going to come and come and come. It was nuts, and we were pretty exhausted. So as far as our own mental health, we're kind of glad that it slowed down a little bit. But now we're kind of like, are people not able to get to us? Because there's definitely people out there.
It is kind of extraordinary, the things that you found along the U.S.-Canadian border, things that the rest of us don't hear about, these migrant trends. But this is essentially a battle, Rupa, between two nations, right? Big nations, U.S. and Canada, over who is more welcoming to refugees. But it also seems like it's about who can do a better job at deterring refugees. And that would seem to be prompted by what's happening here with Donald Trump and immigration.
I mean, there are a lot of different people pushing for different things on both sides. But if we're going to talk about the Trump administration, I think it's clear that they've had a policy of encouraging people to leave. And apparently it has been successful. And at this point, Canadians are just trying to understand what they want to do about it, what kind of country they want to be when the U.S. puts them in this situation.
The world's Rupa Shenoy, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Even if you're not a big soccer fan, you may remember the scandal from 3 years ago. U.S. prosecutors took aim at corruption in world soccer, and they found a lot of it. Dozens of officials associated with FIFA, the game's global governing body, were implicated. They were accused of accepting hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes. In the end, the president of FIFA was forced to step down, but the story hasn't fully played out yet. This week, a former soccer official from Paraguay was sentenced to 9 years in jail by a U.S. federal court in New York. His name is Juan Angel Naput, and 9 years is the longest sentence to be handed out in the wake of the FIFA scandal. A few more details now, courtesy of my BBC colleague, Leonardo Rocha.
What the investigators and prosecutors in the United States found is that Naput was negotiating with marketing companies to take bribes in order to give them contracts to broadcast important tournaments like the Copa America and the Libertadores, and also friendlies from Brazil, Argentina, and other teams.
By friendlies, he means practice matches, of course, not the ice cream chain, in case there was any confusion. Anyway, Leonardo says the Paraguayan media is having some fun at Naput's expense.
They published some statements from his wife saying that he is not perfect and no one is perfect. And then they made, you know, jokes about that. Also, one of the main papers there, ABC Color, published a headline, "From powerful president of the CONMEBOL, the federation, to a cook in a prison in Brooklyn," because he's been working as a cook in Brooklyn. That's the prison where he's going to serve this prison of 9 years in jail.
Wow. A cook in his jail in Brooklyn. That is a steep fall. We leave you today with a fresh new release of an old recording, 1985 to be exact, from West Africa. But honestly, when I first heard it in Togo back in the mid-1980s, I thought it was an even older recording from Nashville. The re-release label known as Awesome Tapes from Africa is putting out this CD. It's called Our Garden Needs Its Flowers, something of a one-hit regional wonder from a duo from Ivory Coast, Jess Sabi and Peter One. As you're about to hear, Jess Sabi and Peter One now both live in the United States. Peter One lives in Nashville and joined us from local station WPLN. He took me back to 1985. That's when Peter One was living in Abidjan, the biggest city in Ivory Coast. And he and Jess Sabi released this album.
We wrote the song in Abidjan. At that time, I was a student at the university, and Jess Sabi was a cartoonist. And we had the opportunity to record it in a studio called JBZ. That was the best studio at that time in Abidjan.
And why the country western folk sound? This is totally not what we think of when we think of West African music. What did you listen to growing up in Ivory Coast?
All kind of music. I would say traditional African, modern African, American folk or English folk and country music, yes, caught my ears very, very early.
Do you remember kind of specific artists you listened to that you feel influenced you?
I would say Paul Simon and Garfunkel.
Mm.
The very first time I was attracted to that music is when I heard the song "The Boxer."
Great
I'm
song.
Just a
Great
poor
song.
Boy, to my sorry sad, I'm told I have counted my resistance. Yeah, I did like this song.
So heavy very influence rich. From Paul Simon, from Art Garfunkel. I mean, the re-release of your recording with Jess Sabi is really special to me because I was working in West Africa in the 80s, and I remember hearing Our Garden Needs Its Flowers everywhere. It was especially popular in the bush taxis with the drivers. I had it in my collection, and then the cassette died, as cassettes often do, and I never dreamed that this really regional release would ever get attention in America, and yet now here we are. How much distribution did Our Garden Need Its Flowers get outside of West Africa?
Ooh, I won't be able to tell you because there's so much corruption, piracy, and, you know, illegal copies made.
Mm.
And one point of correction, when we released that album, the cassettes were not out yet. We didn't know what was cassette. It was only the vinyl.
Yeah, so you're saying that I probably got a pirated copy, the one that I bought.
Exactly, exactly. So it was just the vinyl.
So now with the re-release of Our Garden Needs Its Flowers, it'll be out on CD and digital download. Are you looking at this as a kind of a second life for the album?
I would say a new life because it's not in the Ivory Coast, it's not in West Africa. but in the United States and hopefully around the rest of the world.
So what brought you to the United States and Nashville specifically? How long after you recorded this album?
I left the Ivory Coast in 1995. I came to the United States. I stayed in New York for a year, and I very soon realized that it wasn't that easy. I need more money than I thought.
Right.
Yeah.
And what do you do today in Nashville, and is music still a part of your life?
Yeah, music is taking, you know, I would say 70% of my life, and I'm a nurse right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like at a clinic or a hospital?
Oh, yeah, in a nursing home, a hospital.
Okay. Jessa B is also in the States, in San Francisco. Do you stay in touch?
Yes.
And are you working on songs?
Yes. Whenever we have opportunity to meet, we try to bring in and, you know, work on those songs together.
So when you do your work at the nursing home there in Nashville, are people mm-hmm. aware that you're a musician and you had this hit album in West Africa?
No, they don't.
you haven't decided to tell them?
I think I have to let them know now, since I have something on hand, you know, because I didn't want to, you know, look a little bit weird, or who's this guy talking about music and he has nothing to show us, you know.
Yeah, well, you just sit down in the common room at the nursing home and bust out your guitar and play a few songs. I think people would stand up and be really surprised.
Yeah, I'll do that now.
I know the reception is going to be great.
Yeah.
Peter One is one half of the duo Jessa B and Peter One. Their 1985 album, Our Garden Needs Its Flowers, is getting re-released on CD and for digital download by Awesome Tapes from Africa. Peter, it is an absolute delight to have you on The World. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Can't think of a better way to kick off your Labor Day weekend than with a little C&W from Ivory Coast. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We're right back here with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.